To convene the House Committee on Revenue, our members of the committee, our erstwhile chair has come down with illness, I believe, it was explained to me, an eye problem, and we send him our good wishes and hope for his speedy return to us. In the meantime, we have a couple of hearings on a couple of bills, and so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3087 and ask Lizbeth to explain it to us.
Chairman Berger and committee members, with House Bill 3087, this is creating a new tax credit for the value of volunteer service in community-based health centers for health care professionals who give their volunteer time. It defines health professional advice, or regulatory board, and volunteer service. And so everyone's clear, health professional is not just physicians. It's referring to, in the statute, ORS 676-160. So it includes dentists, dietitians, massage therapists, nurses. I mean, there's just a whole list here of about 20 different things that are referred to as health professionals. So everyone's clear. This is not just a tax credit for physicians. Then it's specifying that the individuals receiving their health services from the professionals be health benefit plan patients or not covered by health insurance. It requires the value of the volunteer service to exceed $889. It specifies that the tax credit shall equal 45% of the value of the volunteer service calculated by multiplying the taxpayer's hours of volunteer service by a specified rate per hour. Then it limits the tax credit to the tax liability of the taxpayer and cannot be carried forward. It provides a prorated tax credit for non-residents and part-year residents, requires community-based health centers to apply to DHS for certification as health centers for which this volunteer service may be eligible for a tax credit. So basically DHS will be the one administering these the credit in terms of how many centers can first of all get this accreditation. And DHS can only certify 3 health centers. So it's very restrictive in the number of health centers that can be certified. Then it's limiting the number of hours the department can certify to a maximum of 750 volunteer hours at these 3 health centers. Then it provides rulemaking authority to DHS to certify community health centers. It requires each health professional regulatory board to annually determine an hourly average rate of compensation that each type of health professional, subject to the jurisdiction of that board, charges for professional services. So each year, basically, these health boards are going to have to certify some kind of an average wage to DHS, and then they're going. But it cannot exceed $125 an hour. Requires each health professional regulatory board to send the board's determination of the hourly wages by January 31st each year to DHS, and then it applies to beginning tax years January 1st, 2005, and it has a sunset of January 1st, 2008. And then it limits DHS to certify those 3 health centers before January 1st of 2007, and then it takes effect 91 days after the end of session. So basically, as far as the revenue impact, I haven't had a chance to do it, but it's only 3 different health centers, and then there's a maximum, again, hours of 750 as far as volunteer hours. This could be similar to the issues we discussed in, with the investment tax credit as far as, the waiting list or, some kind of a how they would actually be determining who's going to come on next to be a health center that would allow volunteer service to then be allowed in those health centers. So,
questions, Elizabeth? Representative Riley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Elizabeth, is there a sunset on this bill at all?
Yeah, it sunsets January 1st, 2008, and it's actually even by 2007, DHS has to have certified those 3 health centers. So they can't certify anymore after 2007.
That's not a sunset on the credit.
Yeah. Well, it's a sunset in the sense that it can only apply to tax years, you know, January 1st, 2005 and before, January 1st, 2008.
So there... There will be no more tax credits after
2008. That's right.
Unless we recertify.
That's okay. Right. So
thank
that's
you.
The sunset.
Thank you.
We would like to welcome Representative Richardson to come forward and speak to this bill, and we're very pleased that you've come down to talk to us, propose this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'd like to begin by saying that we have drafted some amendments that will change and simplify this bill dramatically. After the bill was sent for drafting, we met with some of the people that run these clinics and to talk to them about the bill and the provisions. And they indicated it would be far better for them if it was restricted to specialist physicians, because they have success in getting a number of people that are trained to come in and volunteer, but where they really have difficulty is when a physician says, you know what, we really need a gastroenterologist to take a look at this. And so they asked if we might be able to restrict it to specialty physicians. And so the amendments will restrict it to board certified or to specialties that are certified, and it will be at the rate of $125 an hour, which is only a fraction of what these specialists charge. And it is a pilot program affecting only three clinics, and it's for the next 3 years. It ends through the end of tax year 2007. So it's 05, 06, and 07. And the goal of this bill, and I sponsored it because of my work on human services, I've become fully aware of what the president is doing in putting hundreds of millions of dollars into community-based clinics all across the country to try and promote and assure that there are safety net clinics that can help the poor. And so as my staff and I were looking through, you know, what different states have done to maximize the utilization of these federally funded health clinics, the state of Virginia has a plan that works like this, that is to encourage physicians to donate their time, you know, get a certain percentage of compensation back, but as an incentive for physicians to provide their specialty work and their care through the community-based clinics. And so what we elected to do would be to ask if this committee and the legislature and the governor would allow a pilot test program where we have three clinics that could be allowed up to $97,000 per clinic over the entire period, and the total fiscal on this will be $291,000, and the goal is to see whether or not it works in Oregon, whether or not there is a benefit that's worth this kind of investment in having specialty physicians give their time to people who have no insurance or are poor, and it only would apply to those people that are referred by the staff at these community-based clinics. And so it's very limited. By allowing this to take place, it will help those people not to go to hospitals or to emergency rooms where they may need specialized care, and so the actual fiscal, I think, will be a net benefit. But nevertheless, we want there to be some incentive to help this get some publicity among the specialist doctors, and for us to go and say, we really do need you to contribute some time, and there is a partial reimbursement to you for in the form of a tax credit. So that's basically what the bill is about. It's very limited. We'd like to come back in a couple of years and get testimony from the directors of these clinics as to whether or not this is something that we should go further with or just let it go away, but at least we'd have a chance to find out if it works for Oregon.
Thank you. Our questions? Representative Galizio.
Just a clarification. So the tax credit goes to the health professional or the clinic?
It goes to the health professional. It's saying to a specialist doctor that if you will contribute a minimum of 7 hours, then you can get $125 per hour as a credit against your tax return if you choose to take it.
Follow up?
Yes.
What do you imagine the average annual salary of a specialty physician in Oregon might be?
Madam Chair, Representative Galicio, I can only give you a range, and I think that the range is between about $200,000 and $700,000 a year as far as, I mean, there's some less and some more, but basically I think that's the range.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Riley, you had a
thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming, Representative. Do you have some sense from these folks that they think that this is going to be enough to help them actually get these folks to come out?
Madam Chair, Representative Riley, anything in this direction, they're grateful for. The people that run these community-based clinics are very dedicated people. They just want to help the poor and the needy. Right. And so they were very pleased that without their initiation, you know, that we're, as a legislature, that we're coming forward saying, you know what, we'd like to see if we can help you. And so how can we best do that? And they're saying specialty physicians are where we really need the help. We say, okay, we'll see what we can do about a pilot program and see whether or not we can do something that will help you to do what you do better.
Good. Thank you.
Members of the committee, we do have testimony forthcoming from some other folks, so not to put Representative Richardson on the spot for all questions on this. Yes, Representative Compton.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Representative Richardson, my only thought is, and I'm doing this in advocacy of Chairman Butler, are there community-based clinics in all parts of the state so that we'll have an opportunity as a pilot to hopefully see how this works in different, you know, east and west of the mountains?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Kopp, there are clinics all over the state. The three that we've selected, actually, we don't have them selected, but we did put in the bill that one should be from the eastern part of the state, one from the southern, and one from the north, the western, southern, and northeastern portion of the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Richardson, the three locations, I mean, two locations, I guess, if you're in Medford, you're in Medford, and we have the Community Health Center here, and if you're in Northwest Oregon, that includes Portland. But any envisionment or thought, I mean, Eastern Oregon, first off, there's no major metropolitan areas. Second thing is there's very few specialists. I mean, we're in the rural sections, at least of Eastern Oregon, we have a real problem just retaining simple family practice doctors. Yeah. How do you kind of envision it, or do you have, are there a few candidates that say that they're interested in this out on the eastern side, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, we have not talked with any clinic about specifically sponsoring or being the selected clinic. There, I feel certain that there are clinics in all geographical areas of the state that would be very grateful for this opportunity. After I speak, Mr. Riggs is going to be speaking, who represents community health centers, and so he could address that problem better than I can.
No further questions for Representative Richardson. Thank you very much. We welcome you to stay, or if you must go to...
I'm actually involved in a Ways and Means
Committee. I am sure you are. We appreciate you bringing this to us. We appreciate you coming to speak on it.
Thank you.
And on behalf of the committee and the chair, thank you very much. Doug Riggs, and why don't we invite you, there's Doug, you want to come up next from the Primary Care Association? Fire away.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Riggs, with Northwest Grassroots, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Primary Care Association. I'm appearing on behalf of OPCA, and I want to make sure, in response to some of the questions, that you know that there are 22 federally qualified health centers, which is what Representative Richardson referred to, around the state. It's part of the president's effort to double the number of patients nationwide served by FQHCs, particularly in rural areas and areas that are medically underserved. And we have over 120 sites throughout the state in areas including Medford, Ontario, Prineville, Salem, Portland, Astoria, et cetera. We're pretty much statewide. And there are other community-based clinics, rural safety net clinics as well, that are even in a larger amount of areas in the state. We really appreciate your interest in this issue. This is very important to us. Our clinics are facing very serious challenges as a result of the dramatic reductions in OHP standard. We have some clinics that now have an uninsured ratio of patients upwards of 40% or higher, and that is providing a significant financial challenge for us as we try to keep the doors open in many of our clinics. One point that I did want to make is that most of our patients, even if they're uninsured, do contribute something to their own care. That's one of the models, one of the part of the models for FQHCs. And we also receive federal funding. The federal funding we receive is in a block grant based on the total number of uninsured throughout that particular portion of the state. And it does not go up or down depending on the percentage of uninsured patients we see. And so if you do the math and you add the 15% of the budget we get flat from the federal government, plus the small amount that we get in insurance payments, plus the small amount that we get from contributions from patients, you can see that there's a significant financial portion that is unaccounted for when the state is cutting its Medicaid program, as it has done with OHP standard. And so combined with the dental and the vision cuts that are proposed in the governor's budget, many of our clinics are facing some very serious financial straits. As we've discussed with Chair Richardson, referring uninsured patients to specialists is very difficult for our center directors. As he mentioned, we have a very good, very qualified, top-notch base of skilled professionals in primary care, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. We do not, in many cases, have the kind of very specialized care that is necessary to treat some of the more serious conditions. And so as a result, in many cases, if we can't find a volunteer currently to treat some of those conditions, we end up trying to do it in-house. And that's a challenging and complicated task in many cases. It adds to the time load, the case demand load, as well as the stress level for our practitioners and leads to high staff turnover. Unaddressed chronic conditions are a serious problem, and as was earlier mentioned, as the uninsured population expands, what you see is that if we are not able to treat them directly in our clinics, they're not going away. People continue to have serious health problems, and they're ending up going into the emergency room where the costs of treatment are dramatically higher. And OHSU, I think, presented a study earlier this session which indicated that uncompensated care has skyrocketed in the hospitals. And that has a direct impact on all of us. Health insurance rates for small businesses are going up. Health insurance costs for public employees are going up. And so to the extent that we can begin to address this uninsured issue, we can save costs throughout the system. We very much like the bill. We think it's an excellent start. We'd like to make a couple brief points. The first is that we'd like to see the scope of the bill expanded. We certainly support a pilot project to see if this works out. We think that it will be successful. But if you consider that our clinics have, in the last year, served about 180,000 patients, over 800,000 visits, what you can see is that the proposal is a drop in an already very dry bucket. And so we would like to see if the committee would consider increasing the amount of money that could be appropriated or allocated for this tax credit. We think it would be well spent, and we certainly believe that it will lead to a cost savings over time. The only other point I'd make is that the bill refers to certified community health clinics or centers. We're not quite sure what a certified center is. We know what a federally qualified health center is. We know what a safety net clinic is, but we'd like to work with the committee and with the sponsor of the bill to arrive at a definition that won't add any additional bureaucracy or certification process for the DHS to go through. In conclusion, we very much appreciate your willingness to consider this bill. It's a great start. As I said, we'd like to see it expanded, but it's a very good start, and we support it. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Bofors.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what I'm hearing you saying, and this especially applies, I guess, the best example of the Ontario or Prineville or something out on the eastern side. What I think I hear you saying is that you would use this credit to go out and recruit specialty professionals and some other professionals you don't have, and then once individuals come to your clinic, you would refer them out to these other specialists or doctors, which, frankly, on the other side, could be a little bit of driving involved in this thing, just to get from what I'm a first few out there. Is that kind of what I'm hearing now? I know that would apply also to the Medford area or the Southern Oregon or the Portland area, but we're talking short distance. You might be across town in Portland or maybe from Medford to Ashland, but, you know, hypothetically, if this was Ontario, some of the closest specialists that you're talking about, that Representative Richardson talked about, are going to be like in Portland.
Madam Chairman, Representative Boquist, I think that's certainly the case, although I think if you look around the state, there are specialists geographically distributed throughout the state, not equitably distributed. You have an awful lot higher percentage of specialists in the Portland metropolitan area, Salem, Medford, et cetera. Bend is an example. Bryanville is not a very far drive to go to Bend, and we have quite a few specialists located in Bend. But I think in some of the rural areas, it'll be a challenge. What we like about the amendments to the bill is it allows us to refer a patient to a specialist who's outside of our clinic. And the original bill as drafted suggests that specialists might have to be inside of our clinic, and that would be financially untenable. So we like the ability to refer someone to another site and take advantage of that. But certainly there would be some commuting or driving distance involved in certainly cases where there's only one specialist or two in a particular region.
So we addressed the issue of outside, basically getting outside professionals to help. You envision this being used also to supplement existing professionals' hours, basically through a tax credit, or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I don't really see it supplementing an existing salary of one of our own professionals. Some of our clinics do have some specialists, but we tend to refer most of our patients to specialists who are off-site. I believe that's the case. So for the most part, I'd see it being taking advantage of and being used as an incentive.
Right.
You know, you might have someone volunteer 20 hours and then donate 20 hours on top of what he'll be reimbursed for. Mm-hmm. If you get him in the program and he or she sees the value or benefit of the program, you might be able to expand the number of specialists that would be willing to volunteer with or without the tax credit. And so I think that's one of the positive benefits that might arise out of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Galizia.
And there are no restrictions as to the type of care that can take place at these health centers. In other words, OBGYN could do the full scope of practice at these federal health centers. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Galizio, we are required to provide a wide variety of care in primary care, mental, and dental health, and those are federal requirements, and I can get you a complete list of what's required. But we have to live up to fairly stringent federal requirements about the type of care that we can provide. So we don't have very many restrictions, as I understand.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Compton.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. Berger. Just a question that came to my mind is, Dennis, are oral surgeons part of these clinics? Because sometimes some of the most urgent care that some of us need is to have a root canal and that sort of thing. It's just a curiosity because I don't like to go very far when I need my oral surgeon.
Right. Chair Berger, Representative Cobb, that's a very good question. And dental care has been one of the requirements for new starts to the extent possible in the last several years. There's a financial challenge to getting a dental clinic started. Not all of our centers have to have the dental or the mental visits in-house. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, what we do is we contract with a local private practitioner to be able to provide that service to our people. Okay. And in most cases, their oral surgery is something that's available. As I mentioned, though, the governor's cuts to OHP plus dental coverage would be very serious. In Medford, as an example, we've already shut down one of the clinics in prior years. And if the governor's cuts go into effect, there could be other closures of our dental clinics around the state.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
There may be further questions. But I'd ask Joy Sorts. Am I close?
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Madam Chair, my name is Joy Soares, and I represent the Healthcare Safety Net Coalition. And the coalition is a combination of federally qualified health centers, which you just heard Mr. Riggs speak to, as well as school-based health centers, rural health centers, Indian health clinics, and community clinics. And so all of those entities came together as one body to be able to speak from the safety net as a whole of what the needs are and what would be most helpful for them. And so I'm here today to come forward to say that we are in support of this bill. I'm very appreciative of the work that's being put into it. All of the clinics that I mentioned, rural health centers, Indian health centers, et cetera, they all have a mission or a mandate to treat Oregon Health Plan and uninsured clients. So by their very nature, they have high expenses, and yet their reimbursements are very low, which means that they are at risk for closing. And as the uninsured has skyrocketed in the last couple of years, as well as the decrease in Oregon Health Plan clients has dramatically gone down, that has really put some clinics at risk. In fact, some of them have closed. And so we're always looking at ways that we can go ahead and support these clinics because they're so important. And they are in each of your communities. You all have safety net clinics that your constituents go to. And it's important that they keep their doors open, because if they don't, they're going to have to travel far, or maybe not that far, but they'll end up in the emergency room, which is the most expensive place to have your care provided, and not always the best outcome for the client. That's what we're interested in. Our clinics are very interested in making sure that their patients are healthy so they can contribute to their families and be able to work. And so so the coalition believes very strongly that this is a very wonderful step forward and is very appreciative. And they, too, would like to see this scope expanded, because I know there will be 3 clinic sites selected, but there are over 70 clinics that have high need of trying to get specialty care. And that's actually in urban areas as well as rural areas. And, two, also, they always want to make sure that that you realize how important, actually, the reimbursement from the Oregon Health Plan is for their clients and keeping that afloat. And one of the community health centers, the executive director, her name is Peg Crowley, and she's the executive director of community health centers in Ashland, White City, and Medford. And she sent me testimony that she wrote actually this morning at 1 a.m. That kind of speaks to how dedicated these clinics are to take care of their business during the day, and then in their free time they do things like communicate with you about what their needs are. And so she, I will give you her testimony, but I'll just read.
I believe that it has already been distributed to the committee members, and it becomes a record of the committee, so I don't think it's necessary that you read it.
Okay. Just know that she's very supportive of this and very appreciative.
And we're appreciative that she stayed up till 1 a.m. to make sure that we heard from her on this issue.
Absolutely. Very dedicated.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
We appreciate your coming. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Gallant from the OMA is here. With a large cup of coffee?
Yeah, it's one of several so far today. I did not, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association. I did not stay up till 1 a.m. writing testimony. I apologize for that. The concept of the legislation, I think, is a positive one. Physicians in this state, the Oregon Medical Association did a survey late last year, and among the topics was to inquire how much charity care they provide. And the survey indicated that, on average, physicians provide 5% of their practice to free care, which is a substantial amount of charity care, and I think a positive thing. Most physicians believe that they're obligated to provide free care in a variety of ways in this state and in fact around the world, and do that. I think the concept that this bill has of trying to encourage specialists to participate in this program is a good idea. Other legislation, as you know, has been proposed and is being discussed to try to increase tax credits for physicians who practice in rural areas to try to, again, retain and recruit physicians, particularly in those areas. Since physicians in Oregon are getting older, the bulk of physicians are between the ages of 50 and 60 and will retire soon. Most physicians getting out of medical practice have debts of over $100,000 easily, and so any kind of incentive to assist physicians to provide these services, I think, is a positive one. We, of course, will work with the committee, if you choose to consider this bill and sponsor the bill, to refine the language. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Gallen?
I have one.
Almost got away.
Describe to me, just sort of on the ground, how you visualize this work. This could work. Suppose you had someone, and I'm picking locations out of the air, but someone in Madras or was needed a specialist in oncology that happened to be in Bend, and this person then drove to the office, had a consult, and the physician, the oncologist, then would apply for a tax credit at a minute fraction of his real rate. I think that Representative Galizio pointed out or implied in earlier testimony that $125 an hour is not exactly the going rate for a highly specialized oncologist.
Nor a plumber.
Nor a plumber. The patient leaves. The physician then, under this, would get some minor tax break on his later taxation, but in the meantime, the cost of his office, his staff, his equipment, and everything else would be absorbed by the physician? Mm-hmm. Do you believe that is the...
Yes, I believe that's exactly how it would work. I believe the clinics would contract with, your example, oncologists, or let's say neurosurgeons, or gastroenterologists, or whomever they appear to have a shortage, potential shortage of. But yes, I think physicians would well recognize that they would never be fully compensated for their costs of providing those services. In fact, that occurs today. And this legislature has passed other legislation in the past to try to provide mechanisms for them to do this without fear of being sued, with the exception of gross negligence, for example, and other things. I mean, under the Oregon Health Plan, physicians are the second lowest reimbursed among all providers. Their rate of reimbursement has been increased 9% over the last decade. Their overhead costs have gone up substantially above that, and will continue to do so because of other business pressures. But in the area, in the area of voluntary services, physicians recognize that they will never get a full return for their personal investment. It is, after all, voluntary. They know that going in, and they do a lot of it already. So I think it's a worthy experiment to use an incentive program to see what kind of impact it has. I would encourage this legislation, if it does move anywhere, to in fact have a tracking system so that you would clearly know whether or not it provided the intended benefit in the process. Otherwise, you'll listen to people like me do anecdotal stories about whether it had its impact.
Which begs the question, do we know now how much voluntary medical service from specialists there are to compare it to after this kind of...
Madam Chair, again, in our survey, and I'll be happy to get a copy of the executive summary for you if you wish, this was a broad base of all physicians around the state and including specialists. And so I'm very confident in the approximate 4.5 to 5% of their practices are voluntary charitable care, which is, again, a substantial amount. Yeah.
Further questions? Did you have a question, Mr. Rowley? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, I know your survey is, very broad-based, and it doesn't seem to me that that'll be anything that we can actually compare to and see a difference. I suspect, and I think you suspect as well, that the doctors who are volunteering will continue to volunteer, and the doctors who aren't probably won't. And I hope that's not the case. I hope we can encourage some to do more. But the tracking that you're recommending, how would you suggest we go about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Riley, I don't think it would really be that difficult. You're only going to have three sites. And I'm sure that those clinics can easily inform you of what services they lack before they start, and what services they're able to garner during that period. I just don't think that will be a difficult thing, particularly since it's a targeted experiment.
Seeing no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Seeing no one else in the room really signed up to speak on this particular public hearing, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3087. And we have another bill to be heard today in public hearing, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2785. Elizabeth, it's another health-related issue.
Chairman Berger, this is actually Representative Butler's bill, and it allows emergency medical technicians to subtract from federal taxable income expenses incurred in the performance of emergency medical technician services. It restricts the amounts to those included in federal taxable income for federal tax purposes, and then it applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2006. Now, under current law, we have the miscellaneous deductions that are allowed for any additional expenses and stuff that you incur in order to be employable. And so basically some of these deductions could be allowed, but the problem is the miscellaneous deductions, it has to be more than 2% of your adjusted gross income. So that's basically what I've listed there for you under miscellaneous deductions, your things like any employment-related educational expenses and professional books and magazines, union dues, business-related travel and transportation, meals and entertainment expenses, any work clothes, legal fees connected with your job. And then, as we've talked about, depreciation expenses for the cost of maybe purchasing office equipment that you're using somewhere else besides your employer's office. And so basically that's what you have under current law. The issue, though, is that some of these employment expenses have to be related to, work that you're performing where you're getting paid, not for volunteer work. And so that's what I was told, was that some of these EMTs are doing this performing and having to incur these costs for volunteer work that they do out in rural areas. And so basically these are out-of-pocket expenses that they are incurring that they're not getting reimbursed for. So and basically, after talking with the Board of Emergency Medical Technicians, there's approximately 9,000 of these EMTs certified in Oregon. So that's kind of the range of people. Then it's the issue of, trying to get at some kind of an average expenditure that these EMTs are actually incurring. And so that's the piece that I don't have any information on in order to do the revenue impact. And one other thing to kind of, if we do work this bill more, we could maybe look at an amendment that would just clarify clearly that it's only those expenses that are included already in federal taxable income, because it could be such that you take a standard deduction and then they may also want those people who take standard deductions to have these expenses allowed as a deduction also. So we might consider, if you want to do above the line deduction, then you're getting everybody. So that's just something to consider, maybe clarifying exactly if they're included in federal taxable income, then you would allow this subtraction.
Questions of Elizabeth? As noted, this is our chair's bill, and I'm sure he's very sorry he's not here to introduce it to us. So
actually, it's very effective, the fact that he's not here because of a medical.
Right. It is appropriate.
Yeah, that's right.
Did an emergency medical condition call him out of here? So we will ask Dave Lapoff and Scott Ekblad, if you'd like to come and sit at the table since you're on deck, that would be fine. And that's fine. Welcome.
sit next to you, Scott.
All right.
Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to House Bill 2785. My name is David Lapoff. I'm a volunteer lieutenant, EMT, with the Kaiser Fire District. I'm also a board member with the Oregon Volunteer Firefighter Association, the state association that represents all the volunteers, whether they're firefighters or EMTs in the state. We're very supportive of this bill. It goes right to the heart of recruitment and retention for volunteers. A number of, as your staff pointed out, paid folks, if they're itemizing their income tax returns, they can deduct their items. But not everybody does that. And then with the volunteers, less of those folks do that. A lot of these individuals are, if you've all heard in the past, hosting bake sales and fundraisers to buy equipment for their agencies, well, they're also buying their own equipment, whether it's stethoscopes or scissors, stocking equipment on their ambulances, emergency first aid kits that they carry in their private vehicles. This would allow them to take those expenses off the top of their reportable income, which, why I don't imagine it to be a large number individually. I think that will go right, show them that we care, I guess, for a better way to say that. I really don't have much more to add to that. I would be glad to answer questions. I do have one, I guess, follow-up. Your staff person mentioned they talked to the Oregon Board of EMTs, and I'm not exactly sure who you spoke to. Exactly.
Oh, well, I don't have a name, if that's what you want.
Well, there really isn't a state board. Did you call the Department of Human Services, EMS, and Trauma?
No, I talked with a regulatory board that certifies EMTs.
Oh, okay. That might.
And that's what the bill is addressing, those that are certified in Oregon.
Right. Yeah. And as far as the volunteer, okay, thank you for clarifying that. And for the volunteer side, there is approximately 8,200 volunteers in the state of Oregon, and that encompasses EMTs and
Are those 8,200, you said? Are they?
Yeah, 8,200.
They are certified or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they've been certified by the Department of Human Services, EMS, and Trauma Section. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we have Mr. Ekblad go, and then we'll entertain questions from both of you.
All right. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad, and I'm with the Oregon Office of Rural Health, here today to offer our support for this bill, not only for the Office of Rural Health, but for our advisory body called the Rural Health Coordinating Council. And for those members who may not be familiar with either the office or our advisory body, I've attached the pertinent sections of the Oregon Revised Statute to my written testimony to explain who we are. The Rural Health Coordinating Council, our advisory body, instructed us at the beginning of this session to support any legislation that would encourage participation of rural folks in EMS services. And as you probably know, most of rural EMS providers are volunteer, and it's getting very difficult to recruit and retain paid as well as volunteer EMS staff in rural Oregon. In 2001, our office conducted a survey of rural emergency medical services providers, and one of the things that we learned was that recruitment and retention was a very troubling issue. It was a great concern for these agencies. We then secured, as part of one of our federal grants, funds to conduct a follow-up survey, which we have just recently completed, to look further into the issue of recruitment and retention of volunteers. What exactly are the issues that are making it difficult? What might we be able to do to help them develop strategies to be more successful in recruiting and retaining volunteers? And one of the things that we found is that, in fact, as we had learned before, for those folks who responded to our survey, about 54% reported that their agencies are staffed mostly or entirely by volunteer EMS providers. We also learned that one of the primary barriers to recruitment and retention of EMS providers in rural Oregon is the costs associated with it. And let's just look at the education, for example. To become certified as an emergency medical technician basic, 140 hours of training are required. To become an EMT intermediate, add 120 hours to that total. And to be certified as an EMT paramedic, a person must complete 1,000 to 1,200 hours of training. So there are obviously costs associated with that training. There are costs associated with the exam that they must take to get that certification. And in rural areas, there are also costs associated with traveling to where the education and training is being offered. In fact, we asked our the folks who responded to our survey what they found to be an acceptable time to travel to get EMT education, and the most popular, most commonly selected choice was over 2 hours. So the folks who responded to our survey, the rural folks in any case, didn't really think that having to travel 2 hours to receive either the education for initial certification or the ongoing continuing education that's required for recertification, that 2 hours was too much to travel at all. And, of course, there are costs associated with that as well. Another thing that we learned in our survey is that the rural population demographics are what make it difficult to recruit and retain in recruit in particular in rural communities. And the two things that were most commonly listed as barriers to recruitment were the small size of the recruitment pool and the older age of community members. Rural residents are generally older than their urban counterparts. And when asked about retaining their staff, again, be them volunteer or paid, and when asked to rank what education and training related barriers there were to retention, the majority of rural respondents listed cost of education as the major obstacle. So to summarize, the primary reason that we are supportive of this bill is that if these folks were able to, volunteers in particular, were able to subtract the cost of their education and training from their taxable income, I think that that would go a long way to provide an incentive to recruit folks in rural areas. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Representative Bocas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the wealth of information from the Board of Emergency Medical Technicians, can you two gentlemen just give the committee a ballpark figure of how much in expenses per year do you think an average EMT would be deducting on there under this deduction?
I'll defer to Mr. Lapoff. And
that was pretty smooth. Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, when we're talking about the EMT basics, as Scott described, a community college program is approximately $485, and then another approximately $40 to $60 for books and testing fees. Miscellaneous equipment that they might incur might be another couple $300-$400 in the year. A paramedic, EMT paramedic, community college, don't quote me on this, but I'm guessing a paramedic degree, his associate's degree, probably costs close to $10,000. It works out, you know, they have to have the prerequisites and then specialize in associate's degree in emergency medicine. Most of those folks are, you know, I don't know how you would come up with an average. I would hope as the revenue committee that you would have resources to answer those questions, maybe.
Madam Chair, follow up?
Yes.
I guess that was the wrong way to go.
Well, I guess there's 8,200 members, and I'm just thinking that, I mean, if your organization at some point, if we wanted to go forward with this conceptual idea, could give us something to work with. Of these 8,200 members, you can see, I mean, you've just broken it down to the committee until we got advanced and we got basic and we got this and this one is this and this one is this and this one is that. And being a revenue committee, we have to kind of put a revenue number from this. And, you know, the last time I was a certified EMT was over 20 years ago, so I have no clue what this costs. And if you were able to give it to the committee, I know you can't do it today, but send something maybe to the committee staff that said these are the types of expenses we're talking about per. Give us some sort of indication, because, I mean, 8,200 times 1,000 adds up quick. But if it's 500 or something like that, and I don't have anything to grasp it by. I have a future son-in-law I could probably ask, which I guess I could do that. But I think your information might be more accurate.
Yeah, I think that Elizabeth will have to do some sort of work to come up with some sort of a figure to go on this. I would also note that there is nothing that I'm reading in this bill, Elizabeth, correct me if I'm wrong, that says that it's for rural Oregon.
No.
It's any EMT.
And I don't know that it's clarified in the bill. You're talking about training. So, I mean, are they certified at that point? Because I don't see how all these training hours and the education to get training to be an EMT before, I mean, it seems like that all happens before you become certified.
Right.
And you have to be certified in order to get this credit.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a very good point and one I hadn't thought of. However, if someone is pursuing their intermediate level certification, they're already certified as a basic. Those that are pursuing their basic certification are already certified as a first responder. So I think most folks would be already certified. And they're simply pursuing the next level of their training.
Just as follow-up to my original question, I guess my question isn't to pose it right. Would you be willing to at least send some information to Liz Beth there to give her an idea of what we're talking about here in costs?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, yeah, absolutely. That would be appropriate information. And I think the point that was just raised, I had not even looked at it from that perspective, but the way this legislation is written, a new individual going to an EMT basic class for the first time would not qualify for this until they were an EMT basic, and then their expenses from that point forward would be applicable here. Things that they would have ongoing, obviously they would not have that initial $500 a year training, because you do that once and then you just recertify from that point forward, unless you do as Scott alluded to, where you go up in your certification level to an intermediate and then a paramedic. You do have annual expenses of continuing education costs, but that's significantly less. But that goes back to needing that kind of spelled out and some more information. And I must admit, as much as I'm enthusiastic about this legislation, there's a lot of voids here, and it's really open-ended. And we realize that. I mean, I'll leave it at that.
Yes.
For Elizabeth, I guess, didn't we say the employment-related educational expenses are already under the miscellaneous, and so that seems to be outside what we're really talking about?
Well, but Representative Riley, the problem is you still got that 2% cap, so it's 2% of your adjusted gross income. It's only that amount that's allowed as a deduction.
So
so we would be getting that first 2%.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That makes some sense.
Yes.
Any further questions of this panel? I think that we will take... Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, if I could just also add that our office would be more than happy to work with Elizabeth.
I'm sure you are, and thank you for that. I think we're also going to take counsel of our chair, the proposer of this legislation, and we appreciate, gentlemen, your attention and coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2785. And, Paul, I don't see anything else on our agenda, so I will adjourn this meeting of the House Revenue Committee. Thank you all very much.